Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Mark Krofcheck, a permaculture designer and teacher from Vermont. He is also the co-author, along with Dave Jackie, of the forthcoming book Coppice Agroforestry, Perennial Silviculture for the 21st Century. Mark and I sat down and talked about not only his coppice work, but also keyline design. Along the way, we touch on the species that he recommends a beginner to experiment with when it comes to coppice, as well as his toolkit for this woods work. We also spoke about what species coppice well, including both deciduous hardwoods and some evergreens. This is an episode that contains a number of resources and lists, which you'll find in the show notes. If you value this podcast and what you hear in this episode or any in the archives, please make a contribution to the show. You can find out how at www.thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to Mark. I'll join you afterwards with some thoughts and updates.
Then, Mark, if you could give us a bit of your biography and background, how you came to do what you're doing, and then we can talk about your work with coppicing and other things.
Absolutely. I first started to get involved with permaculture and earth repair when I started my studies in college at the University of Vermont back in 97. I basically was completely awakened to the fact that there were some major ecological ills largely being waged by humans on the planet, and was awestruck at that reality. I had been pretty naive up till that point and felt an immediate call to action in some way, and my interests really started to drive me towards reskilling, in that having grown up in the suburbs, I really hadn't had a need to build a lot of practical skills. So my interests ultimately took me on about a 3.5 year wanderlust that brought me into contact with some amazing educators and designers and practitioners in various parts of the States and parts of Europe, essentially just trying to become a more practical and useful human in the world. And so my skills and interests have largely revolved around agroforestry and forest gardens, natural building, coppice forestry and traditional woodworking, and then keyline planning and soil and water management. So that's a brief introduction into sort of my path. Today I live in the Champlain Valley in Vermont, and I'm in the process of establishing a 50-acre homestead here, putting into practice a lot of these concepts I've been working with and learning about over the last 10 to 15 years. And I work as an educator and designer and consultant, and am trying to build elements of a farm-based business enterprise here on the property as well.
With your mention of keyline design, have you heard that Darren Doherty is working on a new book?
I have actually heard about that book. I just saw a few sampled pages, and it looks amazing. The illustrations by Andrew Jeeves, who totally captivated me with some of Mollison's stuff when I first learned about permaculture, I think are going to even make his ideas and the amazing work he's done that much richer and more easy to digest and understand. So yeah, I'm really excited to see that.
I was interviewing someone from Australia last night, and they happened to mention it. I couldn't think of who he was in the moment because I was thinking of Daryl Fry, who was out in Pittsburgh, who's a permaculture teacher. But then when I heard about that and made the connections, it was like, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Darren was a big inspiration for me. I had first learned about keyline when I took my PDC in 99 in Australia at Tagari Farm with Jeff Lawton. Tagari is the experimental farm that Mollison had set up, I believe, in the mid-90s. And so I got to see this 160-acre farmstead with very highly engineered and interconnected keyline set of earthworks that just left me captivated. And I came back to the States trying to find out where I could learn more, and it seemed that the practice was only really something that was known and understood by a few people scattered around the country. So Darren started doing his world tours, I think, in maybe 2007, or that's when I first heard about him and his work, and had a chance to take a workshop with him back then, and that just totally reignited that flame for me. So I've really been inspired by the breadth and scale of the work that he does.
Now I want to go down the road of Keyline with you, with the work that Darren's done before we get to coppicing, but what was your first exposure to Keyline design? And did you study much of Yeoman's work, or was it the works that have derived from that?
Well, my first exposure was at that PDC that I took in Australia. And so, you know, getting a chance to see a very complex system. I believe there were 15 or 16 ponds cascading from the top of the landscape on down to the bottom over a fairly wide area. So it wasn't the most legible for someone who is really just learning how to see in that way. But some of the existing design maps made it a lot easier to start to put those pieces together, because if it hadn't been for that, my introduction would have been limited to just the things I'd seen in the designer's manual, which are, you know, amazing illustrations, but without being able to actually kind of engage with that and see it in the landscape, it makes it a lot more difficult to really fully comprehend. And then actually during our course there, Jeff was installing a design for someone, or he had an excavator who was installing a design for someone that lived about 5 miles up the road. So we, I believe, stopped there at least a couple of times just to watch that system being implemented. And it was a very simple system. It was a small property, and it basically amounted to essentially like a ridge pond that was kind of midway down the slope, because that was really the ideal spot for catchment, despite the fact that the house was uphill, but there wasn't really opportunities to catch water upslope, and a couple of swales that just ran across that hillside. But it was really invaluable for me to be able to see those ideas being put in place in real time in the landscape, and also to just be able to see those ideas applied on two different scales. 160-acre homestead farm, and then the 5 to maybe 10-acre small holding. So that was my first introduction. I went on to read some of Yeoman's work, mainly Water for Every Farm. And then I think I took 2 5-day classes with Darren. And that's where, you know, I was able to build on the foundation that I already had begun. And from time to time, I have a Keyline subsoil plow, and so I offer that as a service to farmers and growers, and largely these days it's just in the Vermont area, northern Vermont. And so that's been the main element of my business, although I'm always trying to point people towards opportunities to catch and store water in their landscapes.
With your Keyline subsoil plow, is that something that you had made for you, or did you find someone who had them for sale?
It's a little bit of a convoluted story, and I'll spare the details, but there was one other person who took the class who was also really interested in providing Keyline as potentially a service, but also doing it on his property. And at that point, it was kind of this mythical implement that we'd heard about, but didn't necessarily know of anyone that had them. And we heard someone had one 20 years ago, and then that person disappeared off the face of the planet. And so there was one gentleman in the class. His name's Royal Purdy, and he lives in the Finger Lakes area. And he runs a family business called AH Tuttle that I believe specialize in fencing products, but they also sell agricultural equipment. And so they already had the infrastructure to start importing tools. And so they started to build a relationship with the Yeoman's Plow Company. But myself and another gentleman from the Hudson Valley actually ended up putting together our own order. We each bought our own plow, and we had them shipped from Australia to the States. So we purchased our plows directly through the Yeoman's Plow Company. Today, there are 3 distributors I know of in the Northeast. AH Tuttle, like I mentioned, that's the letter A, the letter H, Tuttle. Market Farm Implements, which is down your way in Pennsylvania. And Abe Collins, who is up here in Vermont. And so those are the 3 avenues I point people to who are interested. Most cases, if people were interested in purchasing a plow, at the very least, you would want to buy Yeoman's plow shanks, because that's what really makes the Yeoman subsoil plow a unique tool, or the Keyline plow unique, is the design and the profile of the shanks. So the frame is something that people certainly could fabricate or have fabricated. They have been dialing in the design on that tooling for those applications over time. So I spoke with a friend who's a welder, and it looked like we really would have trouble competing with the price they were able to offer on the plow frame when it came to paying him his hourly wage, buying materials, coming up with our design, all of those things. But I did end up fabricating a roller for the tool, which is important. It basically helps smooth out the texture that the plow leaves in its wake. So the shanks, as they rip through the soil, they cause these kind of vertical furrows. It's not really a furrow. The soil sort of peels up upwards after in the wake of the plow. And so the roller just helps to kind of press that back down and level things out, because that's really not an ideal surface for farmers who then want to come through with mowing equipment or their balers. It makes it a lot harder to do field work if it's not been rolled out. So there are elements that one could fabricate. You can certainly subsoil plow without a yeoman's plow. There are many different designs for subsoilers that exist and that are already in use in the area. It's really just a matter of finding a tool that creates less disturbance and that requires less horsepower to pull and just does a much cleaner job at helping decompact soils, improve water infiltration, and make it easier for plant roots to penetrate deeper into the soil.
And I'm at the Market Farm website while we're speaking, and I can see that they have it looks like there's a Monroe Toughline subsoiling shanks, and then they also have the Yeoman plow shanks available, and some other options depending on what you're looking for.
Yeah, roughly you're looking at anywhere from probably $700 to $1,200 a shank, depending on the exchange rate and the size of the shank that you buy. I haven't kept tabs on what prices are like these days, but if anyone was interested, one piece of advice I would offer is I tried saving some money by buying the 22-inch shanks. And if I were to do it again, or maybe someday I will do it again, or I'll upgrade, I would probably go for the 26-inch shanks, just because you can't rip 22 inches deep with the 22-inch shank. You'd be kind of bottoming out the tool frame. So you can probably go 18 or 19 with the shanks I have, but for the extra $150 each, I have three shanks on my plow frame. For me, in the long run, I think it'd just be nicer to have that option of going just a little bit deeper. So that's one piece I would do differently if I were to do it again.
And Keyline is something that's fascinating to me, so I hope this will be my last question on it. Combining Keyline design with permaculture, what zones would you normally use this type of a plow in?
Like zones of use zones, as in like 0 through 5?
Yes.
Well, I'm a big it depends kind of guy, so that's my first answer, but that doesn't get us very far. So, I mean, it's really like a zone 3 implement, I suppose. Certainly could be zone 2. The thing I find challenging with zones is that I think different people interpret them differently, which I think is good, but it's a function of scale and accessibility, largely. When it gets to be an area that's too big to broad fork in a day or two, and especially if you have access to a subsoiler, it's just going to save you a lot of work. But, you know, sometimes it amounts to 3 passes with the tractor, and you have such a small area. I've done a small community garden that was a postage stamp that was probably a 16th of an acre or something like that. And it took me about, you know, an hour to do the actual plowing, if that, probably 45 minutes. There was more time involved in pulling the plow off the trailer, attaching it to the tractor. We had to rent a tractor in that case. You know, there's a lot of added cost in terms of time and money that made it not that much more. It certainly saved us time and energy. But I would say, you know, anything smaller than about a quarter acre is probably, it's broad forkable. Once you start to get larger than that, I think a subsoil plow starts to make a lot of sense. And really, ideally, it would be the sort of treatments that I would recommend, if people are able to invest in it before you do any sort of large planting, if you're planting an orchard or a forest garden or whatever, taking the time to do that subsoil treatment beforehand is ideally a really great long-term investment, because it's so much harder to do it after you've partitioned that space up and started planting within it. So depending on what tools and energy you have available, I think it can really vary. But bringing it back to your initial question, it's a broader scale zone 2, or most certainly zone 3 type of practice.
I'm just thinking about the rocky soils here in Pennsylvania and what it would be like to pull one of those through this landscape.
We run into the same thing here in Vermont. One thing that I'm always clear with landowners about beforehand is that we're going to likely earn them free rocks as we do this. And that can be another nuisance for folks. The tool is designed to accommodate for the stones in that there's a shear pin integrated into the shank. So the shear pin breaks before you do any damage to the machine or to the plow frame or to the shank itself. It's a hassle to have to hop off the tractor and replace the shear pin. It's not that big of a deal, but it interrupts your flow and it takes extra time. So I usually try to be really sensitive. You're not going very fast. It's usually just kind of a brisk walk is about the speed I maintain. And I try to anticipate the stone, or you can often feel, if it's a big rock, you can usually feel it when you first encounter it. And then what I'll usually do is back up and then pull the plow out and then jump over it rather than break a shear pin or pull up a large rock. With smaller stones, they're just going to get pulled up, and it's a bit labor intensive, but really the best option if you're going to do any field work there, like mowing or brush hogging or whatever, is that you really need to have someone come out and pick those stones and get them out of the field. So yeah, that is unfortunate. And if I had a disposable income, I would totally buy the Yeoman's plow with the stump jump shanks, which have a hydraulic reset so that instead of a shear pin snapping when they encounter an obstruction, the shank actually just springs back out of the ground. And then once you've passed that obstruction, it just resets back into place. But I have to get a permanent shelter over my head before I can think about something like that.
The engineer inside of me just is thinking about that, and I'm going to have to look up a picture of it to see what that looks like. But yes, I very much understand that thought of those investments. A friend of mine who works as a photographer for me from time to time was telling me about what his next camera upgrade would be. And it's, you know, several years of a mortgage on a decent sized house.
Exactly. I think if it was the kind of thing someone was offering as a service, or if it was a tool that was shared, really, I see the ideal arrangement for folks who are looking to do keyline and have a land base to work from is if they could get together 3 or 4 partners who would go in and on the tool together and buy one. Because if you're able to split the cost over, you know, 4 or 5 people, it really becomes a whole lot more affordable, and you don't need it all the time. And you really, your goal is ultimately to make the tool obsolete on your landscape, because once you go incrementally deeper with each pass. You know, once you're sinking the shanks as deep as you go, as long as you're not causing compaction in other parts of your property, then, which invariably will happen over time, but it's the kind of tool that you don't need all that much throughout the course of the year. So it makes a lot of sense to develop sort of a shared model for purchase and use.
It reminds me of something a friend was saying about his use of a broad fork, is that he only needs it for 2 or 3 years before his soils are in a place where he doesn't need it anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
This is my ignorance when it comes to farming and the necessary tools, but is a yeoman's plow something that can be horse-drawn?
That's a great question. I have never seen any sort of frame that has been designed for the yeoman's plow shank, but there are horse-drawn subsoilers. So again, we kind of get into this nuance of the distinction between them, and really it's in the design of the shank itself that the yeoman's plow is unique in that regard. I would imagine that someone could fabricate some sort of frame that would allow them to pull a yeoman's plow shank. I just haven't seen it myself. But I know that it's possible to find draft animal drawn subsoilers.
That's something I'll have to look into. I'm not far from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and there's a lot of horse-drawn implements, including new manufacture in that area. And there's a company a friend sent me a link to. I'll have to contact them and see if they have anything like that.
You're in a good place to find out what technology is out there, and probably could find, I mean, you could certainly find people who would be able to answer that question. What would they need in order to fabricate something like that, and how difficult would that be?
Well, thank you for entertaining my questions on key line design in the yeoman's plow.
Absolutely.
It's an area that one day I would love to get around to exploring, but I have so much other work and learning to do within the permaculture community that that's just for my second or third lifetime. I'll get back to that.
I'll look for you. Hopefully I'll be back around then too.
Well, I think about the broad umbrella that is permaculture and that need that keeps coming up in conversation that really started with when I spoke with David Holmgren was that in the early days, permaculture was intended to be something that was applied to different human systems, that we each find our own specialty and then kind of add permaculture to that work.
Mm-hmm.
But then somewhere along the way, the focus changed so much towards education and teaching and the design work that I guess that became the focus and some of these other pieces got lost in the conversation. But now they're being spoken about again and almost rediscovered. And that's where I think having these different specialties within the community are really important because you spent your time focused on something of deep joy and interest to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the place where I find the same level of interest and satisfaction. So you going down a road that you enjoy provides a better resource to the community than me trying to do it and not enjoying it the same way. And that as we each do our own piece of this and work together, then we build this network of people who know these different pieces and we're stronger because of that than if we all try to be those same generalists.
Absolutely. Are you familiar with Mark Lakeman?
Yes.
I just caught him speaking last night over at the Yes Tomorrow Design Build School here in Vermont, and he was alluding to similar themes in a lot of his work, and it's such a clear impetus for us to just reconnect and re-inhabit our villages and recognize how many skills and resources we're surrounded by. And it's been really exciting for me to start to invest myself in a new place in a small community and just meet neighbors and find out who's the mechanic and who has the, you know, three sizes of dump truck and who knows where we can get the hog for our party and who knows, you know, who you talk to when you have a question about building materials. And so we are really surrounded by almost everything that we could possibly need, but it's building those connections and taking the time to reach out that often kind of stymies those opportunities.
I was fortunate enough to interview Mark last year, and he was part of a series. I interviewed him and Dave Jackie and Larry Santoyo in short succession. And all three of those conversations were about taking permaculture like out of the garden and speaking with them and having them share that piece, having been involved in this community and doing this work for so much longer than I have, was very transformative with a lot of my thought processes about where to go and what we need to do within the community to really build and grow what we're inspired for. And I have to say that some of my inspiration living here in the eastern woodlands of the United States was the work of Ben Law. I received his book, The Woodland Way, as a review copy, and I read it, and it was just, wow, this is the kind of stuff that I can be doing here where I am. A lot of his work translates directly. And it was after reading that in his discussion of coppice, I contacted your co-author, Dave Jackie, to talk about your coppice work. And then in speaking with Dave, he referred me to you as the better person to speak with about coppicing and the On the Ground work because of your previous experiences. And I was wondering if you could share a bit about that, and then we can talk more about coppicing.
Certainly. I was in the midst of that period I'd mentioned a little bit earlier when I was just attempting to meet and connect and learn from people and build skills. And I had come across the Woodland Way. I think that was in 2002. And I was just totally enamored with the picture that Ben paints in that book of his lifestyle and his interconnected livelihoods and just a life that's lived in and around the woodlands. And so being captivated by that idea, I decided to write him a letter to see if he took interns or apprentices. And this was back in the day when I still would write handwritten letters. And actually, I think the last time I visited Ben, he still wasn't on email. He could receive emails, but didn't necessarily get them direct. So it was kind of neat to see someone who's as established as he is still clinging to some of those older technologies that a lot of us don't necessarily use that frequently anymore. So it turned out that Ben does take apprentices. And so I moved out there in November of that year. I guess that was 2002. And I spent about 8 months just working alongside him in the woods, along with two other apprentices. And it was probably one of the most joyful experiences in my life that period of time. People may be familiar with England's climate, but while it's very similar in many ways to the northeastern United States, it's actually incredibly mild compared to what you'd think, given that they're at roughly 52 degrees latitude. I believe that London's at about 52 degrees north latitude. I'm at about 45 degrees here, and it's 80 miles per degree of latitude. So we're looking at close to 600 miles distance between us, but they're that much further north, yet it really never got below 20 the entire time I was there. So it was pretty comfortable working outside in the wintertime, which is the way that we lived our lives, was essentially just, we were snedding coppice in the middle of the woods all winter long. Snedding being the term used to remove the side branches and the tops from the coppice poles. So we probably cut about an acre and a half that season of 18-year-old chestnut coppice, and spent probably the first 3 or 4 months essentially being the grunt labor, myself and the other apprentices. Ben did the felling, and then we would come and clean up the poles and then look for various products in those poles and cross-cut them to length and sort them. And he had a whole suite of different products that we were to be looking for. And there was a, you know, high priority for straight poles because they're highly valuable and can be utilized in all sorts of different applications. Most of his property was chestnut. And so chestnut has a number of really valuable qualities, one of them being its rot resistance. So he would often use it for garden installations, fence posts, trellis panels, outdoor structures, yurt poles, various small built elements up to that point. And so we were looking for poles that were 4 to 5 inches in diameter and 8, 10, and 12 foot long and straight, poles that were 2 to 3 inches in diameter, you know, that same range of length, fence posts that ideally were about 6 inches in diameter and about 5.5 feet long that we would cleave in half using wedges and a sledgehammer, fence rails for like post and rail fencing that were about that same diameter, 4 to 6 inches, but 10 feet in length, and we would split those into quarters. Anything that was curvy and otherwise not valuable for building or craft work ended up on the pile that ultimately became charcoal or firewood. And we were also pulling mushroom logs from that lower value material in terms of its straightness. So we had this whole kind of continuum of potential that we were looking to find the optimal uses for these poles as we went. And as the season progressed and we started to transition into spring, we started to get into more value adding and more craft work and that sort of thing. So making charcoal was something we were probably doing about once a week and this is before I'd ever heard about biochar. So this is barbecue charcoal that there is a market for in England. And so we had, it wasn't like a super complex kiln. It was basically a steel ring with a conical cap on it. And we would make a batch of charcoal. I don't remember the volume within that, but it was sizable. It was about a 6-foot diameter kiln that was maybe 3 feet high. About once a week, we did some fencing installation. We did some hedge laying, some small scale building projects. It was very diverse, very interesting. And probably one of the best things is that our lives revolved around the woods. Once again, we were starting our day with fire. We were cooking all our meals on fire. Once the temperature started to warm up, we basically spent the entire day outside. We cooked our meals on the open fire in this sort of lean-to outdoor kitchen that Ben had. And so it was just a very full, simple, and rich experience that was physically demanding and emotionally rewarding. That was kind of the getting my feet wet and getting really excited about coppice. And then it's been a whole nother process in figuring out how to start to adapt that and share what I've learned and been inspired by as I've spent the last 10 plus years back here in the States.
And my understanding is that you're taking that on-the-ground experience, that body knowledge that you gained with Ben, and applying that to a more academic study of coppice through the work that you're doing with Dave Jackie in writing your coppice book?
Exactly. Dave and I first met probably about 4 or 5 years ago, and it was largely our mutual interest in coppice that helped start to strike up our friendship, and just both recognizing the dearth of information on how to establish coppice, what species are most desirable in this climate, what are some of the products that have the most potential, et cetera. We decided that we would host a weekend workshop just to start to kind of build a rapport between the two of us to open up that conversation and to see where it took us. And as we were working on our outline for the weekend workshop, we realized that there really was a significant need for some sort of manual that could answer a lot of those questions. And it was from that process that we started to explore the idea of writing the book that we wish we had, which is the way that we frame our intentions behind the book, is that, you know, there's something that's very personally motivated in the research that we're doing and that we want to understand and be able to answer some of these questions just ourselves, recognizing that hopefully a lot of other people are interested in those questions. And we've learned that there are many people who want to learn more and want to understand how they might be able to fit coppice into their landscapes. So that's really kind of how the idea was originally born. And as we started to work on our outline for the book, it became really clear that it would be fairly easy to basically regurgitate a lot of what's out there already, essentially take Ben Law's books and some of the other more widely accessible books and try to repackage them in a context that was suited for our climate and our readership here in the States. But we really wanted to go a little bit deeper than what was already written and explore some of those bigger questions about like the physiology of coppice and what is it that actually causes this resprout response to happen. And what are the nutritional value of woody fodder for livestock? And really, like, what are the potential yields in terms of poles or volume of wood per acre for different species? And in the same vein as Dave and Eric painstakingly went on to do with Edible Forest Garden, to create a comprehensive, is a term I use in quotes because I quickly learn how hard it is to be comprehensive with anything, but as comprehensive as possible, a species database for those species that have demonstrated some coppicing potential for climates essentially north of southern Florida, which is sort of our climatic threshold. We're not delving into the subtropics, but basically from central Florida on north, we're trying to explore the range of systems and species that could be of use to people on this continent and others with similar climatic potential.
Now, you say from Central Florida north, how far west would that be within the United States?
Well, our intention is to speak to all climates in the United States except for those subtropical zones. So it gets more difficult. We have less familiarity working in those ecosystems. I have spent time in Colorado and California and the Pacific Northwest, so I at least have some familiarity with those landscapes and their climatic patterns. But it's a lot more challenging to write for a climate that you don't reside, but we at least want to be able to provide people in those areas with resources, because our intention really in writing this book is to seed the movement so that, or to stimulate or further stimulate the movement so that if and when we write a new revision or when we revise the book in the future, we have that much more practical knowledge and experience that we can field from people from the varying climate zones and continue to build on this resource, because we have so much to learn when it comes to establishing these systems in a way that makes sense on a regional level. One of the things that's really fascinated and challenged me in working on this book is, like, as we start to, our book begins with a look at the historical basis of coppicing, and it's difficult to find good examples of that because wood is something that decays unless it's preserved in some way. And so normally it's maritime civilizations who were living in areas that were tidal or were had some fishing culture where we find these like prehistoric relics that demonstrate some engagement with coppice. And when we start to like really consider what it means for people to have been managing the same piece of land for multiple generations, in many cases centuries or more, it becomes clear how much bigger these systems are than just us as individuals or just our generation. And so this is really the kind of thing that we need to start tinkering with as soon as we can, because it's our forebears who are ultimately going to be the ones that will be continuing to maintain and refine what we begin. And so that has been kind of an interesting question and an interesting challenge from a design standpoint, is recognizing that for these systems to really work, we need to be thinking intergenerationally and recognize that they have far more longevity than a human lifespan would ever attain.
It's one of the conversations that I've been having about building functional riparian buffers for farms, because the minimum that's recommended by the local conservation district is a 35-foot wide buffer, but the Stroudwater Research Institute here in Pennsylvania recommends at least a 100-foot wide buffer. And to put that in perspective, for every mile of waterway that a farm or other site has, that can take anywhere from 8 to 24 acres out of production. And the conversation is about, well, how do we build these riparian buffers? But it takes that long-term approach. If you're talking about planting something like walnut trees that will be used as timber-grade lumber in 3 or 4 generations.
It comes back to some really complex roots when we start to look at what are our biggest obstacles in manifesting the potential that we see, because it's really easy to plant those trees, but if we don't know that they're going to be maintained when we're gone, are we investing our energy in the right place? I've been working with a few folks at the University of Vermont who've been really exploring the question of productive riparian buffers as well, and they've been trying to find ways that they can procure grant money in order to study some of the different economic potential. And they've largely settled on elderberries as one of their primary crops, in that it's something that people already have some familiarity with, it's had a shorter term payback, and that they see a burgeoning market for elderberry. So it's reading a lot of the research that I've been working on digesting for this book. It's fascinating to see where and how our efforts get placed in the modern culture, because most research projects need to be designed so that they answer a question within 2 to 3 years. And so when it comes to a system that might continue to produce for centuries or even decades, you know, we often really don't have the resources to ask these bigger questions and to monitor the results over long periods of time. And so we end up having to oversimplify our projects in order to get answers, but we're not necessarily asking the best questions all the time. And so, you know, it's a really interesting catch-22 there, because we want to be able to refer to research and learn from what people have done and what trials and errors they've experienced along the way. But we also, it's really easy to get limited by that because of the fact that we have a much more short-term view on how that information needs to be collated and carried out and fit within an economic model and a calendar that really don't coincide with a lot of the long-term implications of these systems.
I spent last fall and this spring designing experiment questions as part of my graduate studies. And I can say that going through that process and going, well, you know, I just want to know if this tree will grow well in these conditions. And that's kind of a binary yes or no. Did it grow well or didn't it? But very often the questions that one has to pose with that kind of research has to have a multifaceted answer that is more than just a yes or a no. So you can't ask that kind of a simple question. But sometimes that's really all that we're looking to know.
Yeah, it all depends, right? I mean, I've just finished reading through 90 academic journal articles on various aspects of the yield of coppice systems. And all I really want, ideally, is to be able to say it's this many tons per acre or this many, you know, cubic feet per acre, even though I know clearly that it totally depends. It depends on the species, depends on the soil, depends on the climate, depends on the rotation. It depends on so many. It depends on the growing seasons, when they monitored those things, how, what their site prep was like. And that's ultimately what the answers to all of these papers end up getting back at too, is that you have a whole range. They're trialing different cultivars. And so it's rarely that simple that you can distill everything down into just a neat little digestible packet of information. And so it's interesting to figure out how you start to tell that story then, and what information you choose to leave out and what bits and pieces you really highlight and hang on to.
With that thought of focus, if someone listens to this interview and they would like to go out and begin experimenting with coppice work, do you have several species that you might recommend for someone to begin kind of tinkering with? They could plant and learn from in a zone of use that is near where they live so that they could interact with it and tend it more often?
Absolutely. And I'm not going to harp on it, but I again have to say it depends, because it really comes back to what their intention is, but I can add some detail to that. I would totally plant a basswood tree in my zone one space, or a linden, the Tilia Americana, because that's one of the few trees. I'm speaking largely to this climate in the Northeast for this moment. That's one of the few tree species that produce leaves that are palatable, and not just edible, but palatable for people. And so I would maintain that as coppice or a low pollard, which I haven't really defined coppice, which I don't know if it's worth doing just to make sure we're all on the same page.
I would go ahead and do that, as that'll frame out the next several questions that I have. I believe Ben touched on that in my interview with him, which will come out a little bit before that, but just as a refresher, or for someone who this is their first interview.
Great. So coppicing essentially is the most intensive pruning you could ever do to a tree or a shrub, because you cut it to the ground and allow it to regrow. And most all deciduous species, or most all broadleaf species, will resprout. They don't die when we cut them. Ideally, we do it when they're in a relative adolescent state, anywhere between the first 5 and 30 years of their lives. Most species will resprout. And with many species, it's possible to continue to manage them as such on a rotation of anywhere from 1 to 30 to even 50 years, conceivably indefinitely. There are examples of people that have been coppicing the same individual trees for triple, quadruple their average life cycle. I was reading recently that I believe the oldest known coppiced stool. The stool is the term used to describe the stump that's being managed by coppicing. In England is a 2,200-year-old linden tree that was just once again coppiced. And I can't remember where it is in the country, but it has fascinating implications for the ability for plants to be maintained in this youthful, vigorous state by perpetually cutting them back to their root system. And pollarding is a similar technique, except trees are cut usually between 4 to 6 feet high and allowed to resprout from the trunk. And that's a technique usually used in order to produce wood or leaf material for livestock within a pasture so that you can continue to graze in the understory while producing wood or leaves in the quote-unquote canopy above. And so bringing it back to the basswood, I was saying I might maintain it as like a low pollard, maybe cutting it 2 to 3 feet off the ground just to make it a little bit easier to harvest those leaves. And to me, that just makes total sense to have something like that, perhaps even like on the periphery of your zone one. So it's just part of your typical daily routine that you can walk along and pick some of those tender leaves as a base in salads. And so I think that's a great species for people to explore here, even if it's just one or two. On the species note, it really comes back to what are your needs and what resources do you have in terms of space, skill, time, soil. All of those pieces are going to help influence how you design your system, even if it's just a small clump of plants. The other two species I'd say after basswood, which are almost cliche, are willow and black locust, but for good reason, because they're super useful plants. The willow is probably one of the few species that has continued to be managed as coppice here in North America, because most basket weavers really demand or at least require the straight, young, supple, flexible, insect and disease free and lateral branch free young growth that you get when you coppice willow plants. Not everyone is going to necessarily want to weave baskets, but willow as a species that is just remarkable in its ability to root from cuttings has so many different potential uses. I spent time at a coppice operation in Somerset, England, where they maintain about 80 acres of willow coppice, and they make a whole range of products. They're called Coates Wetlands and Willows, C-O-A-T-E-S, Wetlands and Willows. And they've gotten very creative about the different types of wicker products that they weave, be it chairs or tables or baskets or actually wicker coppice-produced willow caskets. And they also sell kits for people to plant living willow structures. So you get a bundle of willow cuttings along with instructions on how to plant and maintain that. So there's lots of cool potential with the willow. It could even be that you're just growing some kindling in your backyard. That's one species that is very adaptable, does really well in wet soils, and grows really vigorously. And then from a more, you know, a little bit larger scale utilitarian perspective, the one that I'm especially interested in is black locust, in that it's a nitrogen-fixing plant. It is remarkably rot-resistant, said by some to last 1 year longer than stone when it's used as a fence post. It is one of the densest, aka hottest burning woods that we have. So from a fuel wood perspective, we can be looking at up to 50% more heat energy than some of our other native hardwoods as a fuel source. And it grows fast. And it's incredibly resilient in terms of the soils it will grow on. I was recently reading a study from Eastern Kentucky, where they were using black locust to recolonize mine spoils from coal mines. And it does just fine in those, you know, very challenging soil conditions. So those three species are kind of the easy, low-hanging fruit that have a lot of potential. But if we're dealing with trees that people already have, then again, I think it kind of begs the question of like, what are the potential uses for those species? So around here, I know a lot of people that have pockets of red maple that are very dense, overstocked, not exceedingly productive from a forestry perspective, but they lend themselves really well to being managed as a coppicestan. And as I think about how we kind of translate coppice from Europe to our landscapes here, I think it's really interesting that we don't try to, you know, force systems into places where they don't necessarily make sense. And what I mean by that is we have, in many cases, some relatively healthy, diverse, uneven age forest stands here in North America, meaning that they're already dynamic in their structure. We have mature canopy trees, as well as large and small poles and saplings that are doing a fairly good job recolonizing sites that have, in many cases, been cleared 2, 3, or 4 times since European colonization. And in my mind, as to how we apply coppice here in North America, it's not that we start to displace those, you know, healthy, robust forests that are already doing really good work, providing habitat, producing wood, sequestering carbon, building soils, etc. But we look to some of those more compromised landscapes that are not necessarily our most productive forest ecosystems, but that would really benefit from human intervention in an intensive way. And we look to how we can start to apply coppicing in those often, you know, neglected edge landscapes. I think that's where we can probably manifest the most potential change. And so those are some of the places where, like, we may end up finding ourselves actually managing invasive species as coppice, in that things like Paulownia or the common buckthorn. Not to say that we want to necessarily, like, enhance the growth and vitality of those species, but if they're what's already there and they're what's growing and they're going to resprout when we cut them, then perhaps it makes sense for us to actually utilize them for some functional purpose rather than just aim to eradicate them. So that's been an idea I've been exploring myself as I start to kind of battle with some of the buckthorn that is creeping into the forest understory here on my property. Why not just burn the buckthorn instead of spray it with glyphosate and try to kill it with a poison? So another invitation is that we don't necessarily need to be working in these intact, healthy ecosystems. I think some of our best opportunities, our lowest hanging fruit, are these often forgotten and neglected and undervalued marginal landscapes.
You just touched on something that I've wanted to do a topical episode of the show on, is that within permaculture, we have all these tools and all these different skills and ways to restore degraded land or use land that is not necessarily ideal for traditional production. And that I see a lot of times when people are looking for land to use permaculture with, they want to find, you know, in the United States, that perfect south-facing slope, so they can capture the most sun and be able to cut down this section to clear a space, and then they want to do, you know, a full productive garden here and kind of follow the techniques and the models that look nice in the books. Whereas there's a lot of opportunity to look for land that is inexpensive to buy because no one else wants it, and use what we have and use what we know to make it productive.
Absolutely. I've been dealing with that myself in exploring my best management options on my own property here. And I have about 40 acres of mixed forest, and I'm really keen to initiate coppicing in certain blocks of this forest. But when I start to look at about 2/3 of the woods, what I see is an already diverse, uneven aged, pretty healthy forest stand. And to my behoove me to go in and cut an entire patch in order to attempt to transition that to a coppice stand. And so one of the things I think that's important about how we frame our book is that coppicing is a tool, and it's not a panacea. It's not better than other forestry systems. It's different. It provides us with a different set of materials. It provides us with a very intensive rotational system, but it's not the solution to our problems, because there are a lot of foresters who are very well-intentioned and very responsible in the way that they prescribe management. And so that, you know, we have a chapter in the book that talks about the suite of forestry systems, and we delve briefly, but at least provide some lip service to some of these more conventional forestry treatments, because I think it's important that people understand that entire spectrum of options and recognize where a selection management protocol might make a lot more sense than trying to actually totally steer the forest in a different direction and try to establish some of these systems. We don't want people to get the idea that we're saying this is what we should be doing. It's this is one tool that's available to us. And from a peak oil and a climate change and a post-carbon economy perspective, coppice can teach us a lot, because these smaller diameter materials are much easier to harvest with hand tools. They're much more easy for us to transport. And they were the fundamental foundation of economies from prehistory on through the Middle Ages. And so clearly they have a lot of benefits. But we live in this time where we have an incredible opportunity to learn from a range of different systems and apply the ones that make the most sense in our context.
To follow up on the piece about species, I was wondering if there are any evergreens or softwoods that are useful for coppice work.
Yes, there aren't very many examples of conifers that have coppice potential. One of the most exceptional, actually, is the coastal redwood. If anyone's ever spent time out in the Pacific Northwest and been in a redwood grove, especially if it doesn't contain old growth trees, you may notice that the massive trees that you see that might be, you know, 18 inches to 3 feet in diameter, if you step back a little bit, you might notice that they're actually forming something of a ring, and that in some cases, those are the stump sprouts, the coppice sprout from the original old growth tree. And as I understand it, much of the redwood industry today is actually harvesting those sprouts from the ancient redwoods. The monkey puzzle tree is an example of a species that is not hardy this far north. It's a South American species that is a coppicing conifer. In the Northeast, the pitch pine is one of the only recognized conifers that will coppice. The pitch pine is actually known for producing epicormic branches or clusters of buds and shoots that form along the stem. And the pitch pine is indigenous to dry, sandy soils that are prone to fire. And so it seems to have evolved that ability to resprout because of its coevolution with fire as a disturbance regime. The bald cypress is another that will coppice. So I forget which species, but one of the pinon pines in the Southwest, at least one of them I know will resprout, as well as one of the juniper species, but I don't want to use the name because I can't recall offhand. But in short, there are exceptions to that general rule that most conifers do not resprout. And there's a technique called stump culture that actually some Christmas tree farms have been using for decades in order to harvest new Christmas trees from the same stump. And this is something people can look up online. The USDA has a publication on stump culture. Essentially, the difference between stump culture and coppice or pollarding is that instead of cutting the entire plant, you are leaving a skirt of branches toward the base of the tree so that it can continue to photosynthesize. So essentially, you're kind of simulating what would happen if the leader was damaged on the tree, and it'll tend to send up a new shoot along a branch that then becomes the new leader. And Christmas tree farmers will then usually kind of prune the tree to favor that one individual. But when we consider the potential that stump culture offers, it seems that it's possible to potentially quote unquote coppice just about any species, although it's sort of a modified technique in that case. But we really don't know what the extent is of species that will respond to stump culture, but most of our classic Christmas tree species, the balsam fir and various spruce species, will respond to that treatment.
Well, you provided me with more species than I was expecting to hear with that question, and I had a little note here about bald cypress specifically, as well as larch.
I don't know about larch. I'm not sure. Not from what I've seen and what I recall, larch is not known for resprouting. I've heard some people say that they've witnessed the northern white cedar sprouting. It certainly will exhibit a form that looks as if it has stumps sprouted, where we see multiple stems emerging in a clump from the base. But none of the research I've seen seems to indicate it does resprout. You know, the only way to really know is to cut one and see.
We happen to have a family friend who runs a Christmas tree farm. So I can talk to her and see if there's any space where I might be able to try some of these ideas and provide them some different options for their work.
Well, and especially for people that make wreaths or garlands or other holiday ornaments, you know, that can be a great technique as well. If you're not necessarily even producing for a marketable tree, but just materials that you use in crafting those products.
They do some secondary derivative products such as wreaths from the cast-offs and such from when they're trimming their trees. So that could be another option. The last question that I have for this conversation, and there is kind of a follow-up for it, is what tools do you use and recommend for people who are interested in or involved in coppice work?
It's certainly possible to do this work without a chainsaw, but it's a pretty valuable tool to have. One nice thing about coppicing is that you don't necessarily need a large saw, so you can get away with a very small saw. And I think that, if I recall correctly, you were mentioning in your conversation with Ben, he was talking about using a battery-powered chainsaw. So, yeah, I mean, that's a good example of, you know, what you can sort of get away with when you're not trying to cut trees that are bigger than 8-10 inches in diameter. Personally, I have a chainsaw and use it. But a bow saw is a great utility tool for people that are doing work without using gasoline or electricity. A really nice pruning saw I find to be pretty invaluable too. I like those quite a bit, like either a foldable saw that I can put in my back pocket or some other type of very sharp pruning saw. And what most folks used historically in England for doing a lot of the limbing work is a billhook. And a billhook is essentially like the tempered machete. It's kind of a cross between a machete and an axe. It's got a wooden handle and comes in all sorts of different patterns. They're not the easiest thing to find in the States, although there are derivations of it that you can find from a lot of mail order tool suppliers. The Woodsman's Pal is an example of one of those tools. I've not used one of those myself, but I'm a bit more partial to the design of the billhook, but I'm sure that they could work well. And part of it is probably just because I learned to use a billhook, and I have a few, so I really like using them. There's a company called Morris, M-O-R-R-I-S, in Devon, England, that continues to manufacture billhooks today. And one thing that's fascinating about the billhook is that for hundreds of years, each region would have their own set of billhook designs that were created around the type of materials that people were cutting, the preferences they had for weight and balance and size. And so there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of different known billhook designs. Today, it's hard to find more than about a half dozen that are being manufactured new. But there are some that have a single bevel. There are some that actually have a flat edge and don't have a hook at the tip. Billhooks generally are about probably 14 to 18 inches in length with maybe a 6-inch long handle. And then a hooked blade, like the nose, the tip of the blade curves in a hook. And they tend to, I don't actually know what they weigh, but they've got a little bit of heft behind them so that as you swing the tool, you don't have to fully rely on strength. You've also got some weight behind it to slice through the wood. But a billhook is a really handy tool to have in the woods. And then if it comes to like value adding and processing, a few different wedges and a sledgehammer are really handy if you're going to be doing any riving, splitting materials for fence posts or various types of built craft. And then also a fro, which is essentially a more refined version of a wedge. It's an L-shaped tool with a vertical wooden handle and then a socketed steel blade that is usually about 12 to 16 inches long. And so the tool itself is shaped like an L, and you drive the blade into the end grain of wood using a wooden mallet. And then you use the handle to kind of lever the split along. And it's a really versatile tool that's great for processing some of these pole wood products and making them into various types of fence panels or woven crafts or rustic furniture or things of that sort. But the coppice worker's toolkit doesn't need to be exceedingly complex. If you're using a chainsaw, clearly you want to have the appropriate safety gear. But otherwise, we basically would just bring a billhook, sharpening stones, tape measure, and a cup for a key. Basically, that was about it. Pretty simple toolkit.
What you said reflects very much on what Ben had shared with us. I appreciate, though, hearing the differences between those two lists. Very cool to hear and to know that it looks like I'll have to continue my search for a good billhook in the U.S. because that was my follow-up question regarding tools. But I have a friend who's a blacksmith. I'll just have to ask him, hey, can you make me one to try?
Well, and I would search eBay. One of the neat things about writing a book and having the process take a fair length of time is that you start hearing from people from all over the place that have various divergent interests. And there was a gentleman that wrote me who said that he has an obsession with billhooks. He didn't use the word obsession, but I imagine his wife might, because he said his collection contained over 1,000 different billhooks and that he largely is combing eBay to find his tools. And you can find Italian designs and British ones. I mean, the things that are out there, though generally they're not available in the States, but that might be your best bet, actually, is to find an old tool just through some sort of exchange like that online. If I'm not mistaken, that Morris company that I mentioned doesn't sell retail, so you can't purchase them direct from the factory. But I know they do have a few suppliers in England, but I can't recall the names. So it is something that people could find and order. The shipping tends to be a bit pricey, but they do make really nice tools. So that would be another option that I'd recommend. My personal favorite design is that Morris makes is called the Clandilo, I believe. Landeilo, which is a little bit of a longer design and it's a little bit heavier. But I really like it. I like the weight and the balance of that tool. But everybody's going to have their own preference. But that's one that I've found is really comfortable.
And I found that with a very quick search, just doing Morris billhook and then LL in Google brought it right up.
Nice.
And I will try to include a link to that in the show notes.
Great.
We've covered everything that I have written down in my notes from this conversation to cover right now. Is there anything else that you would like to add to this conversation for the listeners before we draw it to a close?
Ultimately, for me, the take home in all of this is that we're all learning and we're all participating in this process of rediscovering how we make systems that we know work, how we make them relevant in our lives today, at the scale that we live, in the landscapes we inhabit. And so we certainly are eager and excited to have this resource we've been working on, Dave, Jackie, and myself, become available to people so that we can really help stimulate the growth and evolution of our understanding and knowledge base around coppicing. At its essence, it's very simple. It amounts to cutting a tree with the intention of harvesting those resprouts on a cycle. And as long as you do that in a way that you maximize the stool's ability to get good sunlight, it's most likely going to resprout with vigor. So don't be afraid to experiment. That's the way that we learn. And so we want to know what people are doing. And so the other side of that is to experiment and then let us know what you find works, because the more experiences that we can include in our work, the more rich our end product becomes and the more we all learn together. So we're available at coppiceagroforestry@gmail.com if people want to contact us. And our website is coppiceagroforestry.com, where we have information about the book as well as a blog that we maintain from time to time, just kind of updating people on what we've been learning, what we've been thinking about, etc. And if people do want to pre-order our book, and help kind of continue to kickstart our process, because to date, with the exception of our Kickstarter campaign, we've been basically bankrolling this project out of our own pockets. And so we kind of welcome pre-orders for the book. So if people are interested in that, they can certainly contact us via email.
Well, expect an email from me, because this is a book that I've really been looking forward to since I heard about it. Having interviewed Dave and interviewing Eric, I know how much work and dedication they put into the Edible Forest Gardens. And it sounds like you're putting a similar effort into ensuring that this book on coppicing is well researched, while also combining it with personal knowledge. So I really thank you for that and appreciate it. But thank you again, Mark, for joining me. I really appreciate this. I enjoyed the conversation and learning so much more about key line design and coppicing.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
And that was Mark Krofcheck. You can find out more about his key line and permaculture work at keylinevermont.com. If you'd like to learn more about coppicing and agroforestry and the forthcoming book, that website is coppiceagroforestry.com, and you can email Mark at coppiceagroforestry@gmail.com. There's quite a lot in this episode for anyone looking to implement keyline design or work the woods. If you're interested in getting started, I've included links to the specialty stores that Mark mentioned to get yeoman shanks or subsoiling shanks for a plow in order to do keyline design, as well as places in the United States and abroad where you can find the three beginner coppice species, as well as some of the specialty tools such as the Woodsman's Pal. Also, one of my preferred vendors for hand tools, Lee Valley, happens to carry a billhook and fro. I have both on order as a result of this conversation, and will review those tools when they arrive. Since this was a longer episode, I'll keep these notes short, but two quick updates. If you're interested in a mentored, project-based PDC program, the Open Enrollment PDC still has some spaces available. And if you or your business would like to sponsor this podcast, let me know. You can reach me for either of these or any questions or comments at show@thepermaculturepodcast.com or by giving me a call, 717-827-6266. You can also join in the conversations at facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast or follow the show on Twitter, where I am at permaculturecst. Until the next time, create a better world each day by taking care of the earth, yourself, and each other.